Hi. So I'm used to talking at Comic Cons, not Comic Cons, so I'm a little nervous. So just bear with me for a moment if I get on the tangent about comics. So right off the bat, I just want to state that there's so much that I do not cover in this talk because there's well over 100 years of just comics history, and then with capitalism and oppression, everything like that, like there's no way I can cover it all. Just to let you guys know, and also I've been grappling with this stuff for a few years, and hopefully in the discussion we can all grapple with it together. So with that, fellow geeks, let's dive right into geekdom. So I'm here to make a case that comics, and more broadly culture, is something that socialists should engage with, struggle in, and be in solidarity with. I believe that when we engage, we have more confidence in ourselves and in others. They build their own confidence, and we can push for better care of our mental health and get a different group of people to join into the fights ahead. In this talk, I'll be focusing on the two massive companies, DC and Marvel, just because I assume the majority of this audience probably is aware of those characters, at least somewhat, and not really focus on some obscure characters. So before we get into discussing comics, we need to first understand what body dysmorphia means in relation to mental health and the world we live in. Body dysmorphia, in the simplest of terms, says that you view that there is a flaw in your body, which in turn impacts how you navigate the world and how your mind, thus obviously the clear connection with mental health. This flaw that you see at times can become your main focus, make you not want to leave the house, and become disassociated with the world. In the past several years, due to social media and people being open about how they view their bodies, the body positivity movement has exploded. It is incredible and at times inspiring. It has given so many people a platform to discuss how they've been made to feel about their bodies. However, what led to this movement? Is everyone included in this movement, and why are there people left out? And why do so many people view their bodies as flawed? Why isn't the media focusing on mental health and how we see ourselves? Sonia, writer of The Body Is Not an Apology, which is an amazing book, grapples with these questions. Quote, when we speak of the ills of the world, violence, poverty, injustice, we're not speaking conceptually. We are talking about things that happen to bodies. When we say millions around the world are impacted by the global epidemic of famine, what we are saying is that millions of humans are experiencing the physical deterioration of muscle and tissues due to lack of nutrients in their body. Injustice is an opaque word until we are willing to discuss its material reality. End quote. This book and many others are beginning to discuss and grapple with the material reality of the word and of body dysmorphia in our society, and what that looks like. But what really are the material roots and cause it to be so widespread in the first place? To understand how to solve the problem, we of course know that we need to identify the root cause of the problem. The material reality is that we live in a capitalist society, no surprise to anyone in this room, that is governed by what is profitable rather than by human need. Capitalism has successfully separated workers and pinned ourselves against one another. The reason that they need to divide us is that it benefits employers and owners if there is the binary between, you know, men and women and the wage gap, pinning people against immigrants, you know, their slogan about undocumented immigrants stealing your jobs, and the list goes on and on and on of how they divide us. They make us compete against one another for resources instead of seeing ourselves as having the same interests and collectively competing against capitalists. Quote, separating the individual from the social in order to emphasize the individual is capitalist ideology, not science. Prioritizing individual factors absolves the system of responsibility. And if individuals can choose what happens, they can be blamed for choosing badly, again, letting the system off the hook. End quote. It's an individual's fault that they are poor, that they are black, that they are immigrants, that they are women, that they are queer, and the list goes on. We are blamed for our oppressions in a system that wasn't built for so many of us to inhabit. Capitalism is a system that upholds a certain idea of who should succeed and makes it easier for them to. White, cis-hetero, able-bodied, wealthy men are on top, and this is clear on the images and representation we see. So what does all this mean, though, and why does that not reflect at all the reality of the lives that we live? Karl Marx states that, quote, the activity of the worker is not his spontaneous activity, it belongs to another. It is the loss of himself, end quote. How we view ourselves doesn't belong to us. It belongs to a society that teaches us not to fight against capitalism and the root causes of oppression, to separate ourselves off from the other and to pin ourselves against one another and to view ourselves as lesser and stripping ourselves of all confidence. Body dysmorphia is an outcome of a form of capitalistic alienation. Our labor does not belong to us and neither does our appearance. The image we get back of our best self doesn't actually reflect us, but what capitalism needs us to view to survive. As the amazing modern-day philosopher Natalie Nguyen on her YouTube channel, Counterpoint, states in a video on beauty, quote, that we, the woke, know that beauty is power, that beauty is political. Does that awareness mean I desire any less to be conventionally beautiful? No. End quote. So where do we go from here? Change in society can change our desires and loosen the death grip of beauty standards that leads to horrible things such as the infamous toxic masculinity. The stripping ourselves of confidence is the first thing that happens before pinning ourselves against one another. Naomi Wolf speaks about that and how advertising has been able to do this in her book, The Beauty Myth. Quote, the more lethal a material hindrance women have broken through, the more strictly and heavily and cruelly image of female beauty have come to weigh upon us. During the past decade, women have breached power structures. Meanwhile, eating disorders have risen exponentially and cosmetic surgery becomes a fast-growing specialty. And 33,000 American women told researchers they would rather lose 10 to 15 pounds than achieve any other goal. More women have more money and power and scope and legal recognition than ever before, but in terms of how we feel about ourselves physically, we may actually be worse off than our unliberated grandmothers, end quote. Now, the beauty myth came out nearly 30 years ago, and there are aspects that are highly disagreed upon, and there's aspects that I do not agree upon at all, but the core of her argument still rings true, and this is why it's still taught in a lot of women and gender studies classes. Since this book was published, the explosion of social media and technology makes this ring even truer. It expands past women and involves all genders who are uncomfortable with their body, and advertisements do a great job at selling us things to fix ourselves. To make women smaller, men more muscular, black women more white, to appropriate cultures, then to erase them, and so many more. Quote, we need not to do anything other than turn on the television for evidence affirming how desperately our society, our world, needs an extreme form of self-love to counter the constant barrage of shame, discrimination, and body-based oppression enacted against us daily. End quote. So now I'm finally going to talk about comics. Don't worry, I'm not going to spoil the new Spider-Man film, though it would help for this talk. I will say, though, it breaks my heart every time someone leaves a Marvel film before the end credits. Stay, there are two scenes, they're really great. So, what is everywhere right now? Superheroes. I can't even keep up with all the media that is out, and I'm attempting to do this for a living. Endgame made over $2 billion in 3 days. It's back in theaters right now, with additional footage to try to break even more records. Superheroes are everywhere and on everything from clothing to lunchboxes. You can make your whole life into a comic book. Throughout the years, the heroes have become more diverse, from one white woman to, you know, black woman. Though the past several years in the movies, the number of white dudes named Chris or Tom playing a character is still overwhelming. There are a limited amount of queer representation on screen, with comics, and even within comics, and at the moment, there are no trans or gender nonconforming heroes on screen. That will be changing very shortly, and I'll get to that later on in this talk. There's one thing, though, that has been a constant in comics and adaptations that has given us for years, and that is toxic masculinity. So what is toxic masculinity? Is it fists before words, ownership of another, with an emphasis on owning women, narcissism? What is it? Now, that's a very uncomplicated bullet point definition I just gave. We live in a society where we have named certain traits either masculine or feminine, and thus determine how people perceive you, how you perceive yourself, and how you move about the world. Toxic masculinity is stripping away any of the feminine traits from oneself and having a hyper focus on the masculine traits. Most emotions are seen as feminine, from crying, from dealing with how you view yourself, expressing when you're hurt. The one that is seen as masculine is anger. So stripping oneself of the confidence of expressing other emotions means that you mask them usually with anger, which unleashes so many toxic outcomes. So in the 1970s, the two big companies, Marvel and DC, were doing what they've always done, you know, infusing their comics with politics. During this period, though, they decided to ground their comics and really focus on race and class issues. One of the most popular comics that came out during this time was a run by Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams at DC, Green Lantern and Green Arrow. Though they were talking about important issues, the toxic masculinity trope still lived on. And Remy does a great job in his book, The New Mutants, Superheroes and the Radical Imagination of American Comics, which is a great, great book. And he kind of talks about specifically this comic from DC. Those who don't know, Green Lantern is a superhero who has like this green power ring, and the power ring, he can do anything with it, fly, create a big fist that comes out of the ring, whatever he kind of imagines. And in this comic, he can't really use the ring. And so he has to use his fists in a lot of it. And in this book, he takes accounts from readers and what readers sent into DC. And one reader said, quote, "Green Lantern's struggle is internalized and reconciled through an independent expression of masculine willpower, exemplified by a show of brute physical force and disavowalment of feminine authority in his dismissive description of his ring as Mother Hen, holding him back from his true self," end quote. So these toxic tropes we get of male heroes have always sort of been around. These characters embody what a man's man is. I would argue the reason why is they're created by creators who don't fit into the trope of what a man should be or of who a man can be. So let's take it all the way back to the 1930s and 40s with what the far right has claimed as one of their heroes, Superman. Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster said of this character, quote, "Superman is the champion of the oppressed, the physical marvel who has sworn to devote his existence to helping those in need. He fought corporate greed and crooked politicians and preached for social reform at every turn," end quote. He was on posters in schools denouncing racism and racist rhetoric in the 60s. Superman is an immigrant from Krypton, an alien planet, and he was created by two teenage Jewish immigrants. His stories show the complex nature of trying to blend into the culture he's been thrust into while still loving and trying to get more immersed in the one he was forced to leave. So Superman still has a lot of those toxic traits to him, even though he was created to show what oppression looks like and for these creators to really create this marvel of what they view and for other people to view immigrants as good people, as saviors. So in the 1940s, Superman, as he was drawn, he was not drawn with the huge muscles that you see Henry, whatever his last name is, that plays Superman in the movies or the comic books that come out right now. None of the male heroes were drawn with ginormous muscles, and none of them represented what we would see right now. We would see any one of us as superheroes in the movies right now if it was based off the comic and how they were drawn back then. So let's take a look at the movies. Chris Hemsworth, who plays Thor, gets bigger for every film. I would love to talk about Endgame right now, but I will go on a rant about it, about how Thor is portrayed in that film. I think there are a lot of positives with Thor being created. I also think there's a lot of negatives and toxic tropes with Thor in that film, which you guys can bring up if you want in the discussion. I will just literally talk forever about that. But there are countless videos online now showing the intense workouts and the diets for people to get just as ripped as your favorite superheroes. Like, ESPN had like a body issue about superheroes that you can get intense on, and all the superheroes just like had six packs and giant muscles. I would say right now that Spider-Man Homecoming probably is one of the top films that has some of the most diverse body types. Though the bodies aren't the heroes, they're all the sidekicks. I would argue that the reason why these toxic tropes of anger, talk later, punch now, hating women or using them as objects, and being insanely ripped come from a place of body dysmorphia from these creators of both the movies and of the comics. The creators that didn't or don't fit into the trope of what a man is supposed to look like, so they're able to create the heroes and use those heroes as a reflection of what they view that a man is supposed to look like. Though they, of course, infuse them with some good qualities, always with attempting to save people and fighting for the oppressed. So why does all of this matter? Well, it matters because there's an audience for all of those films, and superheroes are on top of everything right now. You cannot meet one person who has not at least heard of a superhero film. Also, there is a certain audience in the comic book community that eats this all up and represents so much of this. For the longest time, I referred to them as gatekeepers of comics. The men that would test your knowledge to see how real of a fan are you, would ask you if, but is it your boyfriend that got you into comics? It must have been your boyfriend, your dad. You actually don't know this. Let me quiz you on how many actual volumes of this comic there are out there. Which most of the time they like to quiz people, that like ends up quizzing them, so. But there's an aspect of this community that we don't talk about, which is the far right. And they are huge in this community. They are trying in so many ways to make sure that comics only reflect one type of hero, because this is their ballpark. This is what they have. They hate representation and they love Donald Trump. So much so that comic books about Donald Trump, a big famous one is on its second volume and is promoted at such cons such as San Diego Comic Con, which is one of the largest cons for comics. There are also two new far-right favorite comics, one about a Confederate flag-waving superhero named Rebel, whose villain is SJWs, and a white vigilante who turns immigrants over to ICE. These comics are just the beginning, though. Ike, who's a chairman and former CEO of Marvel, donated over $1 million to Trump in 2016. The far-right has started a thing called Comicsgate, similar to many ways of Gamergate. Comic gates target anyone who is writing, doing art for, a part of any movie, on panels, talking about anything that they view might support social justice, or they view as social justice warriors. And they will try to make sure that they do not have the narrative. So, let's talk about James Gunn for a moment. James Gunn got fired immediately from Disney when it came out that on his Twitter, like 10 years ago, there were tweets about pedophilia, about small children, sexist tweets, racist tweets. But what a lot of people don't know is who uncovered those tweets and who made sure that the public saw those tweets. It was somebody on the far right who is a known rapist who wanted to make sure that James Gunn did not have any power and could not create the Guardians of the Galaxy as he saw them as social justice. He thought that James Gunn did a disservice to those comics and wanted to make sure of that and take down someone that he viewed that social justice warriors upheld. So James Gunn got fired right before San Diego Comic-Con. He was supposed to have Hall H is like the biggest room and the biggest platform at San Diego. He was supposed to have a panel there about his new film, which is tanked because it got no PR, which was about what if Superman came to Earth and was actually evil and killed people. It's like a horror type film. It came out, no one saw it. But he's recently been rehired, which has caused a lot of weird problems, and I have a lot of weirdness with it because it's done two things with his rehired. One, it has given the far right more ammo to say that SJWs actually don't care about any of this stuff, that we're all fake, that we don't actually know. And it's given the small portion of the far right to be like, oh, James Gunn is now our hero. We can treat people the way that James Gunn has treated people and we're not going to have any consequences. So, like, I've gotten death threats and rape threats from talking at cons or for just having a social media that is about superheroes and stuff like that and immersed in that field. And, like, me talking with other people in this field, we're all nervous for, like, what's going to be happening if this keeps happening. So things are complicated, to say the least. We need to get back to a place with the comics and being created by writers that feel protected to say stuff like punch Nazis. On the cover of a new hero at the time, Captain America, his first ever cover, he was punching Hitler in the face. This cover was created by Jack Kirby. Kirby, a Jewish immigrant, was unsurprisingly against Hitler and the Nazi regime. This cover came out before the United States entered into the war. It had an incredibly big impact on the American public, being one of the most sold comics since the debut of Superman. And it actually galvanized a lot of people to be like, what are we doing about the concentration camps that are happening in Germany right now? And there's a really great story of Jack Kirby in his office. Nazis used to come and try to like get into the Marvel office to like go get Kirby or go get any of them that they thought were Jewish immigrants or were for immigrants in any type of way. And there's a story about Jack Kirby one day just getting fed up and like rolling up his sleeves and trying to get down there and being like, I'll punch a Nazi. And like the people in the bullpen actually like holding him back, being like, no, there's too many of them. Like, this is a bad idea. So we need a fight for the type of representation, because not only can we be in the arena where the far right still thinks that it's winning, but we can use this to educate people and to build up people's confidence. So let's talk about the education aspect. Black Panther was a cultural phenomenon of a movie. It was created by Jack Kirby and Stan Lee and appeared for the first time in Fantastic Four, issue 52, in July 1966. Shortly before this issue was released, the New York Times ran an article about the Lowndes County Freedom Organization in Alabama, whose logo was the Black Panther. The organization, led by the increasingly radical Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, was referred to as the Black Panther Party. So, Marvel quickly changed the name of the character from Black Panther to Black Leopard because they did not want to show any type of alliance at first with this party. However, the new name only lasted for about a year before it was changed back. The character became Black Panther again. Because black readers took issue with the name change. Also, Marvel's demographic at the time was college-age students who supported the Black Panther Party and were taking part in the civil rights movement. And they said that this character, they were able to help educate people about the liberation struggles that were happening. And the Black Panther comic was made more relevant and meaningful by conflating it with the Black Panther Party. So they actually won and convinced Marvel to change the name back. The release of the movie has, at the time, helped fuel calls for the release of black political prisoners in the US, including real-life members of the Black Panther Party who fought for liberation in the 1960s and 70s. In New York City, activists gathered outside the theaters during opening weekend to draw attention to the former Panthers who are still behind bars and to call for their release. It helped galvanize a movement. Unfortunately, they have not gotten any of them released, but it did help put that back into, especially New York City, back into the limelight. And the activists said that it was a huge boost for the movement. So X-Men was created in 1963 during the Civil Rights Movement. It showed racism through the lens of fantasy. It's no wonder why Professor X and Magneto are parallels to Malcolm X and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Like, literally, there are quotes from their speeches in the comics. Then in 2012, issue 51 of Astonishing X-Men, to celebrate the legalization of gay marriage, the cover showed a long-term couple finally getting married. It got a lot of backlash from the far right, but I think it's pretty incredible. I have the comic. X-Men kind of reflects the times and has demonstrated the bigotry of society, but also potential of what we as a society can be. I would say that these movies involving X-Men characters are probably pretty, like, some of the most inclusive ones as well. Specifically, I would say Deadpool 2. You see more body inclusivity into Deadpool. You see more just different people in Deadpool. I mean, Domino is amazing. The actress that plays her is amazing. You even see a photo of Karl Marx in, like, the X-Mansion, which is, like, pretty cool. I don't know. I saw it with a bunch of socialists, and everyone was like, oh, it's Karl Marx! And people in the theater kind of, yeah. Anyways. Now I'm going to switch over to television a little bit. Netflix shows for Marvel have been pretty great when it comes to this stuff. Daredevil, you know, where they show a main character who's blind and they darken the show whenever it's from his perspective, which I think is a really great step. And then you get Jessica Jones, which Jessica deals with the effects of post-traumatic stress after being under Killgrave's control and the guilt of having him affect other people in the way he did hers. The second season picks up where the first left off. Jessica was attempting to figure out what's next while still dealing with everything that Killgrave left with her. The first episodes makes it clear to the audience that unlike other shows with a plotline concerning sexual assault and domestic violence and then forgetting about it, the show will not. Jessica is confronted by another PI trying to get her to join his practice, who says, quote, "I never take no for an answer." Jessica responds, "How rapey of you." This sets up the season to further the conversation around sexual abuse and rape culture and domestic violence. You also see Trish Walker, who was a 15-year-old actress. She was abused by a much older director on the set of a movie, come face to face with her abuser. When asked about the relationship between Jessica Jones and the movement Me Too, Rachel Taylor, who plays Trish, says, quote, "The fact that our show kind of serves up as a mirror for the moment of the time is very powerful," end quote. The director said they did it for a reason. The writers did that for a reason. When Jessica is dealing with her emotionally heavy situations and different forms of trauma, Killgrave comes back to her. He doesn't rise from the dead like most comics, where characters never actually die. He comes from a hallucination. In one scene, he delivers a powerful line, quote, "I'll be in your dreams too. I'm inside of you forever," end quote. Jessica Jones shows the complexity of what healing looks like. It reveals how Trish and Jessica went through abuse, dealt with it in vastly different ways, and are still dealing with it. The show starts to tackle mental health in a way that is unlike most shows. Mental health activist Eleanor Longdean summed up the current approaches to mental health as, quote, "There's almost always ask what is wrong with you and hardly ever ask what happened to you," end quote. Jessica Jones starts to really dive into that question, or as a wizard, a character who's super fast when he's frightened, tells Jessica, quote, "With great power comes great mental illness," end quote. As Alana Kaplan wrote in the review for the British Independent, quote, "The Netflix character is a physical embodiment of women, of the fight women endure on a daily basis. Physical and sexual violence, a lack of safety, emotions, emotional manipulation, harassment, discrimination, and abuse," end quote. The Netflix shows are great, other than, you know, Iron Fist. We don't need to talk about that one. Luke Cage is also really incredible and did a lot with the Black Lives Matter movement, tied in a lot with that movement. Let's talk about DC shows. DC has a streaming platform that is actually failing right now. They released it at a bad time. They are not making any money. The shows that they put on them are slowly getting canceled. But their CW universe is doing really well. Black Lightning is incredible. Batwoman, who showed up for a cameo, was really popular, is one of the prominent lesbian characters in DC. And she's getting her own show. She's actually played by a lesbian actress, Ruby Rose. You even get The Flash is pretty good. It has a great amount of different body types, different genders, different races, everything like that. There's a backlash for who they actually cast for certain roles because that show is supposed to be very white, but they changed it. It got a backlash from the far right. They also got a backlash when Barry Allen, The Flash, cries because he has emotions in that show. And it was like, whoa, men can't have emotions. And that's actually, you see that in a lot of the CW shows is that men grapple with that. Arrow, not so much. I don't like Arrow. We can talk about that later. Acting's very horrible. Anyways, let's talk a little bit about... DC's also doing a really great thing. They just announced a live-action show, Titans. Hopefully it will be actually made, but because they're losing a lot of money right now, who knows at this point. The show casts Chalamet as Jericho. Chalamet is a prominent deaf activist, a model, genderqueer, and Chinese-American. So to do that for a hero, to have a genderqueer hero, is incredible, because there is representation right now with trans and genderqueer actors and stuff like that on the shows for Marvel and even in the new Spider-Man film, but they are background side characters. They don't really have much lines. And then there's, of course, other Valiant Comics, different comic book companies that have more inclusive titles, one of which is Saga, which is upstairs actually in the book room. If you want to get it, it's a great comic. Everyone should read it. Love it so much. Lumberjanes, Bitch Planet, the list goes on. And those comics are all really great. Marvel and DC right now have dropped in comic sales under 90%, which they've never actually done before. And these indie comics are gaining more power, which makes Marvel and DC comics scared. Because they're dropping. I mean, they still have like over 80% of the market, but for them it's like terrifying. Representation matters because it allows us to see that all bodies are beautiful, gives confidence to people, and allows people to understand and uplift each other's differences instead of making us tear them down and pin us against each other. We have the power to do that, to make the world more breathable for everybody in it. In New Mutants, there's a quote, in this commitment to protecting the political interests of the alienated social groups, the superhero has the potential to redefine the meaning of political freedom in America by recognizing the rights of those excluded from the national community, end quote. We need to not just push for it on screen or in physical copy of comics, but also behind the scenes as well. One reason that there's still gatekeepers is because of the rise of fame of the comic book world and who is a part of the comic book world and what writers are a part of the comic book world and artists and everything like that. It's really sad that in 2016, the first ever black woman was hired to write a comic by Marvel. It was Roxane Gay, and her comic quickly got just canceled. Which is like, I liked the comic, it was really great, but like it's sad to say it took to 2016. So there's a reason for that. Marvel and DC's adaptation of the Work Made for Hire Clause in the Supreme Court revised copyright law decisions in January 1978. Under the revised law, employers own the rights to any work they contract from a creative producer unless explicitly stated otherwise in their contract. This has stripped and continue to strip the creators of their power or their control of their own labor in these two big companies. So there are certain contracts by certain writers and certain artists at Marvel and DC where they own their work, where they are famous, where they make a lot of money. But a lot of them live paycheck to paycheck. Kelly Sue DeConnick, who wrote Captain Marvel, lived paycheck to paycheck while writing Captain Marvel. And like, granted, I don't have a quote for that. She told me that in a writing session I had with her about how at Marvel, like, she doesn't own anything. She didn't even know at that time when I had that if she'd be asked to be a consultant on the Captain Marvel film. So the indie comics, like the big indie comic names right now, were actually created by workers who left Marvel and DC and wanted to create better companies. Thus, those people who now like are writers for them, you see Saga, Bitch Planet, Lumberjanes, the comics that I've mentioned, the creators of that actually own the rights, are part of the rights to those comics, and don't have to live paycheck to paycheck. There is a nonprofit in the comic book world called the Hero Initiative, which is backed by Marvel Comics, which I think is funny, because it gives fans the chance to help your favorite creators live and pay their rent, pay their medical bills, and everything like that. Marvel's a backer of that like nonprofit, but they're not actually paying their workers any amount of like what they actually deserve to be paid. So there are several organizations within the comic book industry that are fighting for the workers, that are fighting for representation. Be Super, a tribe called Geek, which is all led by indigenous people. They actually created the first ever Indigenous Comic-Con 4 years ago, and it was a massive success, and they keep doing it every year. They are great. There's also Black Heroes Matter, which is an extension of Black Lives Matter. They have done protests at cons. They will speak up when there's a whole panel of just white people, which they have on diversity all the time. And it's incredible, and all these groups actually work together, and we're trying to build a coalition. So there are so many reasons why socialists need to get involved in this space and to contest for it, to make sure the power of this space isn't taken over by the far right and make sure that they don't think that this is a space that they can win. There has been so many things that have been cultural touchstones in the comic book universe that has had a ripple effect over all of us here. I'm sure we're here because we've seen at least a movie or heard of them. So we see them, I see them as educational resources. I'm not saying that the politics in all these comics and these movies are great, they're not, but there's aspects of them that we can use to educate people on different movement struggles and get them involved in movements. It is proven. Also, we already see at dozens of protests, there's always a sign about a comic book character, about a sci-fi character, about something. It is reaching certain people already without us having to go be like, look it, in Guardians of the Galaxy, we can talk about the prison industrial complex. Look it, we can talk about immigrants with Superman or like, it's already happening. So we need to like get in there and make we can explode it in a different way because they want it. There are panels that I've been asked to be on in the past 2 years about socialism in these spaces. And like, I never thought growing up in this industry that I would ever be asked to be on a panel about socialism and explaining that. Haymarket Books had a table at WizCon last year, which was incredible. And this year, because Haymarket, we didn't have a table there. They were like, I kept getting asked, you were the girl at the Haymarket. Where is that this year? What are the new books? What's happening? So like, there is a need and a want for this in that community. And like, we need to take that and use this moment to really educate so many people that want that. So I guess the question that I'll leave you guys with is, how do we do that? How do we get more involved in this work? I mean, I've listed out examples, but are there more examples of how we get involved? And why has the left on any large capacity not done that yet? Why have we not been engaged in different cultural struggles? I mean, we see how well Teen Vogue is doing and what they're doing. And like, I remember talking to people on the left about Teen Vogue like 3 years ago and people being like, it's culture, like it's Crystal, like, come on. I'm like, no, it's important. And now, like, look at it. But we lagged behind as a left uplifting Teen Vogue. Like, it's sad that this is the first year they're here. I'm happy that they're here. Goodness. But, like, we can take a step into that arena and actually use that to educate and get more people into the struggle. So I guess I'll turn it over to all you fellow geeks to help me grapple with those questions. Thank you.